This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
For once in my life, I have someone who needs me. Someone I've needed so long. For once enough,
Motown Records with a soundtrack for a lot of people who came of age in the 60s. Great dance records and soul ballads by performers like Smokey Robinson, Marvin Gaye, Gladys Knight and the Pips, The Temptations, The Four Tops, The Supremes, Mary Wells, and Little Stevie Wonder. The ups and downs of the Motown story have been told by its performers, but now founder Berry Gordy has told his version of the story in his new autobiography, To Be Loved. Gordy's formula for success combined competition and cooperation. Friday mornings, he ran meetings in which the label's songwriters and producers played their latest tracks and then voted on which would be released. Some records never made it. Some were sent back to be reworked. Berry Gordy told me the story of what happened during the Friday meeting that Norman Whitfield played his production of The Temptations, singing Ain't Too Proud to Beg.
My comment was I didn't really believe David Ruffin was really begging. He didn't sound like he was begging. He didn't sound like a man in pain. So after a couple of weeks, Norman came back one the next week, and it was better, but we turned it down again for some of the same kind of reasons. The following week, Norman came in there, and David Ruffin's voice jumped off that record. You know, I know what you want. I mean, I can't, I'm hoarse, but you know what I mean? The record, he jumped off there. I mean, he was like singing for dear life. I mean, you would know that was a smash. And Norman had the fire. Norman brought the fire out.
I know you want to leave me, but I refuse to let you go. If I have to beg, plead for your sympathy, I don't mind, 'cause you mean that much to me.
As a part of the system you created at Motown was, if a record wasn't good, that kind of forced the person to either give up on the record or to do it better. So there was this always pressure to do it again, do it better. Well, here's another story with it. Tell the I Heard It Through the Grapevine story, how that got changed at a Friday morning meeting.
Well, it didn't get changed. It's just that we rejected the first one on Marvin Gaye. And that was also done by Norman Whitfield.
Norman Whitfield had produced Marvin Gaye singing I Heard It Through the Grapevine.
He had produced it on Marvin Gaye. And but at that time, Marvin Gaye was singing love-type songs. I had told the producers, I thought, that Marvin had this great sexual image, and he was so great and had this wonderful, smooth voice. And I wanted them to think about doing you-type songs, you know, you singing directly to women, you know, because I just felt that would be good. So they did that. Marvin was very successful with that. You are my pride and joy. You are a wonderful one, you know. And he even had one word, you. In the mirror, I look in the mirror and I see you. So it was really working really well. And then finally, Norman came up with this song, Grapevine. I Heard It Through the Grapevine. It was about gossip and, you know, Love Me No More. It was still a love type song, but I wanted Marvin to stay where he was. So we had a thing that Holland Dozier Holland had written called Your Unchanging Love, but it was you, your unchanging, talking directly to the women. And we released that instead of Grapevine. And so Norman was very upset. So later he then produced Grapevine on Gladys Knight. And it went to number one. And of course, And Your Unchanging Love didn't do that well. And Norman never let me forget it. So a year later, he kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me to release it again. I said, wait a minute, it's already been out. It's been number one. And you can't, you know, I mean, it's been a year, just number one. And so Norman said, well, I was right before and you were wrong before, so I want the record released and blah, blah, blah. And it's all in the book. And he followed me around. So we ended up releasing the record in an album.
The Marvin Gaye version of Grapevine.
The Marvin Gaye version in one of Marvin's albums.
Mm-hmm.
We released Grapevine, and the disc jockeys loved it so much, they played it, and we had to pull it off the album, and it went also to number one and sold even more than the original Grapevine did.
I guess this taught you to not always trust your taste, but to trust the process that you had set in motion.
That's right. The process was the thing. We're all humans, and we all have our thoughts and ideas. But as long as it was a free society, and people could win by logically winning, they had to have a point. They had to be right. Two and two is four, I'd always say, you know. And long as they knew they could do that, that's what made Motown so different. They weren't locked in. They didn't come to a place where they were, like, limited. They could go, they could dream anything, and it could be possible.
My guest is Berry Gordy, if you're just joining us. The founder of Motown Records has finally written his memoir. It's called To Be Loved. It's interesting to me that sometimes after a record came out, you decided, no, I don't like it. I'm going to do it again. So when Smokey Robinson's Shop Around came out, you described you were listening to it on the radio and you thought, the beat's too slow. We got to get back into the studio and redo it. Well, now how can you do that once the record's already been out? Disc jockeys have it. Disc jockeys are playing it on the air. Isn't it too late?
They said it was in the company, but I said no. I was petrified at the fact that this record was too slow. It sounded too slow. It had sounded great before, but somehow when I'm listening to it, I'm saying I'm pulling the record. It's going and it's just chugging along. And I'm said. And after 3 days, I couldn't sleep. And I just said, hey, I got to do it again. And I don't know what the problems are going to be. I don't know what it is. All I know is I got to get this record out and tell them to send back the other ones. And it was probably a crazy thought, but it wasn't crazy because no thoughts are crazy. So I called Smokey at 3 a.m. in the morning and woke him up. He got in the studio. We recorded the song. The piano player didn't show up, so I played. But I had the life. And Smokey felt it when it was picked up a little bit, and he even got a little more life. And then, of course, when the record went to number one or number two or whatever, a big, big hit, it was just... It was great. But it was a trouble. It was trouble changing it, but it hadn't been out long enough to really take hold. And a lot of people didn't know it was a different record. We just sent it out again. And so somehow the very first one had not really picked up that many stations, and it wasn't ingrained in, I know when my publisher read that, she read that story, and she said, I hope you don't have any ideas like that about the book.
Right. I figured she'd be thinking that. Well, why don't we hear Shop Around, the faster version, I suppose.
Yes.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around.
Shop around.
Ah, there's some things.
My guest is Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown Records. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Berry Gordy, he's written his autobiography called To Be Loved. Tell me the story of how you found the Supremes.
They came in to audition for me, three young girls in the early 60s, and they were called the Primettes, and I thought they had something. I heard them and their lead singer with their little whiny voice, which was Diane Ross at the time, and I really liked them.
What did you hear and see in the Supremes that made you realize they could really make it?
Well, I saw an electrifying personality in the lead singer and a very enthusiastic feelings from the other two girls, and each one seemed to have had a different personality, but all of it was they were young and they were eager and then they were cute.
You and Diana Ross became lovers. You write in your book that you were both very discreet, although you figured everybody at Motown probably knew. Martha Reeves, in her recent autobiography, said that she felt you were paying so much attention to Diana Ross that you were paying less attention to the other women artists, particularly less attention to Martha Reeves. Did you ever worry about that yourself, that your attention to Diana Ross might happen at the expense of time you could be spending with others, or at least that they would perceive it that way?
Well, no, I never thought about it, because at the time that I took interest in the Supremes, it was long before I had interest in Diana Ross on a personal level. And it was because the Supremes were able to do Broadway-type songs, and they had put on a happy face, you know, by Somebody Loves You, and Rockabye Your Baby and Dixie Melody, and things like that that impressed me so much. Without a piano, they were so great. That gave me the idea to expand our base. So I was fighting hard to get them to do that on TV, because no one would let them do it on national TV, only their hits. I knew that if I could get the Supremes to break through in this area and get into the Copacabana, for instance, it would be at the benefit of the other artist. And it was, because Martha and the Vandellas never would have gotten into the Copa had the Supremes not gone there first and opened the doors, not only for other Motown acts, but for acts around the world. I mean, of our same kind of acts, you know. And so that was a thing. So it is, I think that when Martha and the other artists read my book, they will get the same kind of reaction that Diana got and Smokey got and all the rest of them that read it and really understood. Smokey already knew what I was going through because he was with me before the company, and he saw me get that check for $3.19 or whatever, and he knew what I was going through, so he always had a lot of sympathy for me. But the other artists that just came along and went into that front door and came out another door star, and they had to go through this whole cycle of success of being famous and all this stuff, and so naturally, if I'm not there and I'm with another group that I really thought had great possibilities to take us to new horizons, and that's what I did with them. It is true that I spent a tremendous time with Diana, and it did take me away from a lot of things, you know, a lot of things. But I'm certainly very happy I did, because everybody benefited by the Supremes' success. They were the first to get a number one record in Great Britain, and then everybody went over there. I mean, so they're international stars today, in part because of the way the Supremes opened doors.
Now, in the book, you write about the child you had with Diana Ross. After you had separated, she got married, had a child, and you say as you watched the child grow, you realized this child was yours. So when she was pregnant, you didn't know.
That's right. That's right.
What was it like to find out afterwards?
Well, what was it like? I don't know. Mixed emotions, obviously. But you know, when we realized that it was a possibility, it was a very interesting feeling. You know, I mean, first of all, I was very proud in one sense. And very kind of shocked in another, and I couldn't figure it out. And then it was we figured out that we had been together one time after we broke up, and obviously that had to be the time. So I don't, you know, I don't. I mean, that's what it was. And when things are, we deal with them. You know, that just happened to be a situation that we had to deal with, and we didn't think anything that just happened, and it's one of those things. I was, frankly, I've always loved the little girl. You know, she's always called me Uncle Bebe, and I was a friend of the family's, and the other kids were, when they were born, I've been so close to the family that it wasn't a major, I don't think, trauma for Rhonda.
Now, let me ask you to tell the story of one of the songs that you wrote. Why don't we do Do You Love Me? This is a song that you wrote. You even did the demo for it, right? The demo recording?
Yes, I did.
Now, this is a song about somebody who is asking, do you love me now that I can dance?
Yes.
Do you dance?
Yes, somewhat now.
Somewhat.
I mean, I haven't, okay. But a long time. I've been writing a book, and I haven't done a lot of anything for the last 5 years. But that was the song that I remembered when I was going to dance, is that I had trouble dancing well enough for the girls to like to dance with me. You know, the other guys were always smoother, better dancers, better looking. It was always, I was not quite good enough. But dancing was a big deal in our neighborhood, and I couldn't dance. But later on, when I was in the record business and I wanted to write a song, I thought there must be other people like me. There must be other people that feel the same as I do. So every song I wrote started out something that I felt, but that I also felt that everybody felt, because I realized we're all really the same. We want happiness. We want love. We want peace. We want, you know, it's a matter of us communicating that to each other, and then we will basically kind of love each other because we want the same things. So I felt that that would be the situation with this song, and so I, you know, just said, you know, you broke my heart because I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. But now I'm back to let you know I can really shake them down. Dun, 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 dun. Do you love me? And I had this growly, rough voice, and of course the contours they had a guy named Billy Gordon, and he heard. And I made a demo after the session. I was so excited, and I sung the whole song in my gritty, low voice because. And people said, oh, boy, you should record that. You should record that. I said, no way, no way. And then he sang it just like my demo, but much better.
You broke my heart 'cause I couldn't dance. You didn't even want me around. And now I'm back to let you know I can really shake 'em down.
Motown is the only record company I know of that had an anthem. It was written by Smokey Robinson.
Yes.
How did it go?
It was we'd all get together in the company meetings, and whenever we closed the meeting, we'd always sing the anthem song, and everybody just had such fun singing that, and it sort of went like, oh, we are a very swinging company, working hard from day to day. Nowhere will you find more unity than at Hitsville, USA. Our employees must be neat and clean and really have something on the ball. Da-da-da. Honesty is our only policy. We're one for all and... Now we're all for one and one for all, yes. We are a very swinging company, working hard from day to day. Nowhere will you find more unity than at Hitsville. I said Hitsville, yeah. I said Hitsville, USA.
Oh, that's so funny because it sounds more like a high school what's the alma mater, you know?
Right, right. Well, that's
like a Smokey Robinson song.
That's right. Well, that's one of his proudest songs, believe it or not. Because he was in a contest, and we had contests for everything. Uh-huh. I said, okay, we need a company song, and I wanted to sound like those rah-rah songs. I wanted to sound like a college anthem or whatever would make inspire esprit de corps, what I'm looking for here. And they all had a contest, and Smokey came up with it.
Barry Gordy, it was a real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Barry Gordy is the founder of Motown Records. His new autobiography is called To Be Loved. Gordy sold Motown in 1988 for $61 million. I'm Terry Grossin. This is Fresh Air.